And I remember starting off a group with about 15 men. And on my left was an Indigenous Australian guy, an older guy. And on my right was a Pacific Islander. I said, "Hey guys, we're sitting in a circle." And I turned to the Indigenous man and I said, "You know what a circle is, don't you, brother?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said to the Islander, I said, "You know what a circle is too, don't you?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay. We know what we're doing here, you know." And I said, "In this circle, I'm the elder. And you know what that is, don't you?" And they said, "Yeah, right." And I said, "I give you permission to call me out on any bullshit that you feel is coming from me."
Amen.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and we are in search of the new compassionate male. And I am the producer of this podcast, and I am here with the founder, Clay Boykin. Hi, Clay.
Hi, Dennis. How you doing?
Just wonderful. Would you please introduce our guest today?
I'd be happy to. Patty Murray is with us today from Tasmania. And I have to tell you, this is the first time I've ever had a conversation with anyone in Tasmania. And I'm thrilled. Patty's just recently come out with a book on men and has a history of doing men's work as a counselor in all kinds of capacities. So I'm thrilled for us to have this opportunity to meet one another and to talk.
Me too. I would... Patty, I'm so grateful that you'll give us some time today, because it appears to us from here in the United States, especially during COVID times at all, that the that the systemic structures that had underpinned the patriarchy for this these last 10,000 years, Code of Hammurabi and all of that, it appears to be crumbling at a time, so to where, but something has to step up. It can't just crumble. Something has to step in. And this is where we're seeing the search of the new compassionate male. And so we came to you.
Well, I'm here.
Yeah. Well, so welcome to us. So can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in Tasmania and what you're seeing of the world and the changes of the world right now, and how we as men and the male, the divine male energy can both arise and meet some of the needs of the world, please?
Sure. Look, Tasmania is, you know, an island on the southern part of Australia. Mm-hmm. Our closest landmass apart from that is the Antarctic. And we are COVID-free. We did have some cases early on, but being an island, we're able to lock down.
Sure.
And... We had a few outbursts, but our government here was very strong. We cracked down very quickly and quarantined people. So we're COVID-free. Mm-hmm. So that's. I mean, we're all constantly vigilant because we know, even as in New Zealand, which was COVID-free, things can reemerge.
Absolutely. And your work with men in Tasmania, can you talk a little bit about what you're doing in this book that you've just put out on how we can both connect and grow in our men's fellowship?
Yes, look, my men's work has predominantly been on the mainland of Australia, in New South Wales, which is our major state. And I trained at 45 years old as a counsellor. And I've done a variety of work with prisoners, Vietnam vets, behavior change programs for domestic violence perpetrators, plus general counseling and working with men's organizations around men's groups. And my particular skill has been facilitation of groups. And 6 years ago, I did some preliminary research around the world of the knowledge body we had around facilitating men's groups. And 3 months ago, I thought I would, I was witnessing a resurgence in interest in men's groups around the world. I'm yes. a participant in a Facebook men's group, which has 5,500 men and from around the world. Mainly, it started in Australia and it's equal numbers in the US now and the UK, but it has Africa and Europe. Mm-hmm. And I was noticing a great deal of interest. Yet there was, it was like everyone was reinventing the wheel.
Right.
And I thought I really should revisit my earlier work and write a comprehensive resource on men's groups. And I decided to make it quite a comprehensive, deeper work. There were many quick how to do it stuff around, mm-hmm. but there wasn't stuff that was looking into the deeper philosophical and psychological principles involved, and initiating a conversation and a dialogue, you know, where people could explore. And that was a huge work. As I started it, I thought, gee, you know, do I want to do this? You know,
I've got, right, I hear that.
I've got, you know, I'm a sourdough bread baking teacher. I've got chickens and vegetables and I make things, you know. And so I put the question out to what I call the ancestor group. And I said, listen, guys, and when I meditate, I have what I call a cloud men's group, you know, and it's got my mentor, Don Boak, who's passed, who was a great inspiration, and other men. And I talk with them, you know. So I said, guys, look, I need some direction here. I'm not really up for this unless it's really important, you know. So I want you to let me know. And the answer came back very loud, very clear, you know. We need you to do it and we want it done well and get on with it.
Wonderful.
So I said, okay, guys, you know. And so I dived in and it was an extraordinary journey because I had to ask myself, who was speaking here, you know?
Yeah.
What voice? And I realized that I was responding to that material success paradigm of trying to be all things to all people mm-hmm. and be slick and professional. And I thought, oh, that's just so much bullshit, you know.
So you got over that.
Yeah. Very nice. Hey, very few of us do.
Right.
Patty, that is a great accomplishment.
Yeah. So I thought I can only speak from my depth and my voice. Whether it's opinions or facts or evidence, just let it out, you know. Okay. I mean, and that was a great relief. Like I was saying, who gives a shit? People either take this on board or they don't, you know. Yep. So And in a recent podcast, I was speaking about my work with men, homeless men. I'd had a built a very big project for homeless men with 200 men and about 1,000 men a year. And I ran that for about 3 years. And that was like being in a war zone, you know.
I can imagine. What did you learn about yourself during that 3 years?
Well, it was, I suppose I went into it with a subconscious thing of compassion, you know. And I wasn't fully aware that that's what it was. You know, it was a naive sense. Prior to that, I'd had an experience. I was originally an economist, but when my father died, I went sideways, and you know, was a blacksmith, fencing contractor, baker. You know, I put aside the conventional career path. And I was, shortly before I set up the Homeless Men's Project, I was working in a large landscape doing some fencing. And there were some men in the distance building a bridge. And I'd done a lot of work on building sites and everything else. And so I had a connection with men. And in Australia, you know, builders laboring, you'd have Greeks and Italians and Yugoslavs and the whole variety. And I was standing there in the field, and I had this sense of enormous compassion for the men building that bridge. And it was like they're suffering, they're striving, they're wanting to provide and giving it their utmost. And it was an extraordinary sense, you know. And I don't know where that came from, you know. It was, it just visited me. And so it was sort of like a revelation. And not too long after that, I had a back injury and was getting that sorted, and I couldn't do manual work. So I undertook a course of massage and acupuncture, which got me right again. And that process started a spiritual journey for me. Anyhow, the Homeless Persons Project came up, and I set that up. And your question was, what did I learn from that?
Yes.
It was really life-changing for me, you know. Caring for those men, like being il padre, the father, you know, for men who were twice my age, some of them, people out of prison, alcoholics, drug addicts, people with mental problems, people from war zones in Lebanon and that sort of thing. And we only had one rule, and that was no violence. We didn't, we had a kitchen, so they had a clean room, clean toilet facilities, and good food. And we managed it to make sure that they had access to all health services, mental health services, and that there was no violence and no harassment by police, because given the place's history, the police sometimes would see it as a bunch of poor people who had no rights. So we had to struggle around saying, no, you know, back off. These men have the same rights as anyone else you deal with. And that was a difficult balance act, because at times we needed the police support when things went pear-shaped, and other times the police were harassing people, you know. So that was a bit of a juggling act.
Sort of like life, isn't it, Patty? Bit of a juggling act.
And, yeah, one story, I had one of the men there was a middleweight boxing champion, and I used to do the rounds at night, and when I came back, Les was there and offered me a beer, and I didn't drink when I was on duty, but I thought, oh, well, I'll have a beer with him. And in the conversation, I said to him, Les, one thing puzzles me. No one's touched me or threatened me here. And I said, why is that? And Les looked at me and he said, well, we know you can handle yourself. And I thought, what is he talking about? He's a middleweight boxing champion and he could have knocked me over like a feather. And there are other men who could have knocked me over. And so I went away and I thought about that, and I thought, what does that mean? What are they talking about? And I realized that the statement, you can handle yourself, was, you're the father, you're in charge, you take no shit, you protect us, you stop the violence, and you love us, and we know that, and you speak the truth.
Wow.
Oh.
And for them, like, that was gold.
Wow.
If you've dealt with prisoners and homeless men and violence perpetrators, one thing you learn is constant is the dysfunction of their childhood.
Yes.
And the lack of trust and the lack of sense of security in their upbringing and life. So if they could find someone that they felt openly loved them and was honest and had no hidden agenda, that was gold. And so I was to be protected at all costs. So,
Clay, you have, this is what your foundation of the men's circle, Patty, it's like you're translating your experience to everything that Clay has brought about, that you've brought about, Clay, in the men's circle. I mean, trust was your big issue, and right, trust of men, as you were talking about. Did you resonate with Patty there?
Absolutely. Patty, you know, from totally different parts of the world, of course, I'm not dealing with prisoners in the depth that of experience that you have, but it really resonated with me when you were talking about troubled childhood, lack of trust, not being able to connect with another man. I mean, just right down the line. And I'm really interested in, you would develop circles, or you develop men's groups, if you would, you know, whether it's a subset of those out there. And I'm just curious how you came together, and what kind of environment was it that you were creating in that group? And just how do you proceed through that? I know there's, you know, different types of guys, and different circles need different, you know, facilitation techniques. But, you know, can you talk about that some?
Well, yeah, there's special purpose groups, you know, like Vietnam vets, the behavior change programs, prisoners, and then there's, you know, men's groups in the ordinary community, you know.
Right.
And the prisoners, the vets, and the domestic violence perpetrators are the ones that require the most creative input from facilitators. The professional, laid back, carefully speaking therapist. It is, you know, it just doesn't go down.
Right.
You have to be fully present. You have to be vulnerable. You have to have a sense of humor.
Yes.
And you have to prove that you're a real man, and that, well, I mean, and I say that it in a sense as a real man, as being vulnerable, humble, real, stuffed up, you know, all of those things that they are.
You know. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, Clay, is that not exactly what we were finding in search of?
Well, yes, Patty.
The new compassionate male, this archetype? Please, yeah. Clay.
Well, Patty, the what started our circle was me, my lack of trust in men, realizing that, you know, I was – there were some things in the world that I just needed to learn from another man. But my life experiences brought me up such that I couldn't connect with them. Like, I didn't trust them. You know, what's your agenda? And I reached a point where it was like, I've got to get over this. Because if I'm feeling this, other men are feeling this. There's got to be somebody out there. And if I can create a safe space for us to come together in trust, I'm not there to teach anything. You know, I've got a topic, a conversation. And we did everything counterintuitive. You know, it's a network and not a group. It's a gathering and not a meeting. We have topics of conversation and not topics of discussion. Everything to break down the conventional thinking and to create a safe space, because that's what I needed. And we organically learned and we kind of grew from there. So it's somewhat different language, but I think it's really parallel and complementary to what you're talking about in this particular sense.
Look, I remember sitting with a group, a multicultural group, violence perpetrators there, a mandatory program, mm-hmm. Which I designed because I'd done the government ones. They were pretty awful. So I designed my own program. And I remember starting off a group with about 15 men. And on my left was an Indigenous Australian guy, an older guy. And on my right was a Pacific Islander, you know. And then there were all sorts of, you know, Arab, European, Vietnamese people in the group. And we sat in a circle, you know, never a classroom, you know,
right,
within a circle. And I said, hey, guys, we're sitting in a circle. And I turned to the Indigenous man and I said, you know what a circle is, don't you, brother? And he said, yeah. And I said to the Islander, I said, you know what a circle is too, don't you? And he said, yeah. I said, okay. We know what we're doing here, you know. And I said, in this circle, I'm the elder. And you know what that is, don't you? And they said, yeah, right. And I said, I give you permission to call me out on any bullshit that you feel is coming from me.
Amen.
Because I'm only an elder. If I can earn your respect in what I'm doing here, you know. So you have my permission. And in mandated programs, that's important. You know, I used to say to the guys, everyone here passes, okay? Day one. Everyone passes. So don't worry about having to please me. You can call me out on anything. I don't care what it is. And I'll respond, you know. And then I'd say something like, now let's get into it, guys, you know. And just they became volunteers. And they felt cared for, they felt safe.
And trusted, right? I mean, you were trusting a power greater than. Yeah, I mean, you were talking about where the communication comes from in the writing of your work or the permissions you were giving. There, certainly in my life, and Clay, you've seen in your life, that there is a communication, that the universe is user-friendly, that we get an opportunity to be able to say there is something greater than we are, just in the sense of whatever, however you would define it, but then it comes in and it channels through you.
Yeah, it is a channeling. And the men subconsciously know that.
Yes. And that's where their trust is. They build it. They get that trust and authenticity.
The other thing I learned to do in these special groups is to talk about what I call the core guidelines that I worked on. Because I realized that I presumed certain basic core ethics and guidelines that I based my work on. And I realized that, of course, that was presumptuous. I hadn't stated it to them. I hadn't shared that with them. So I'd noticed that generally that men, when you talk about ethics, everything gets a bit dodgy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People disappear. You know, it's like everything judgmental that's ever happened in their life suddenly comes up in front of them. You know, for me, it'd be the Monsignor mm-hmm. in the local cathedral
yeah.
telling boys not to be dirty and to keep their hands out of their pockets, and like every morality statement you've ever come across.
Yes.
And with the current sort of couple of decades of the negative media narrative about men, you know,
mm-hmm.
Violent, toxic, and that, you know, like men had, you know, disappeared into the trenches. It just wasn't safe.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in a way, they had lost control of their own sense of ethics and their power mm-hmm. to be a man of ethics, you know, defined by them, not by someone else, not by some Monsignor, not by some politician, not by some preacher, not by some feminist narrative, you know, what they felt as men was an ethical stance owned by them that they could stand up for. And I did a lot of research and stuff around ethics, and most of it was just of a scholarly nature. Most of it was just unintelligible. And I was heavily involved in Buddhism, and that was a comfortable spiritual framework for me.
Yes.
And I ended up one day, the core guidelines for living or ethics just came to me, and it was a simple 5-point statement. And it started as, one, we all have choices. Two, we're responsible for those choices. Three, we can choose to do things that are wholesome and positive for ourselves and others. Four, we can choose to avoid harm to ourselves and others. And five, we can take up the challenge of refining and reflecting on how our thoughts and actions impacted in either a wholesome or harmful way on others.
Wow.
And that was it.
Mm.
So
that's beautiful, Patty. Patty, that is so clear and cogent and like a scalpel cutting through all of the Gordian knot of this and that.
Yeah.
And so I'd say to these guys, look, before we start, I need to share with you the core guidelines or ethics that this course is based on. And if you can't accept this, then there's nothing you will gain from participating in this program, you know, because it's the basis on which the program is run. And so I'll share that with you now, and we can talk about it as long as you like. And we'll see how that goes. So I would explain these five basic principles. And I'd say to them, guys, you know, how are we doing with this? You know, like, is this a fair set of things for living our lives? Do we accept and understand those? And every man would just say yes.
You had a real cross cut of cultures sitting in that circle, in all those circles. Incredible.
And I suddenly realized that they were hungry for something simple and positive as a guideline. They had never had that in their life.
Yeah.
And here was someone saying, hey, look, here's some simple stuff. You know, this works. This is good.
And you put the power in their hands. They have choice.
Yeah.
It's not imposed. No, you have choice. It's beautiful.
Their ownership. I agree. How beautiful of you demonstrating that you were going to trust them and you were going to go first. You would be the one to offer the trust before they demonstrated anything.
Mm. So, yeah, it's there. It, you know, it can be done. You know, and the men respond. You know, like I had the totally unknown event in mandated perpetrators programs. I had men asking if they could bring their friends along.
Oh, my.
Mm. Absolutely unheard of.
Oh, Patty, what one of the things that I love about getting to know you and meeting you is that you reinforce the belief in me, in my belief that the human being yearns for purpose, yearns for an opportunity to be able to stand up and to do something worthwhile. It's built in to our DNA. And it's on us to ask more of ourselves and to be able to have the kind of guidelines that you're having. I mean, when I grew up, I'm 72 this year, so we're cohorts, but I grew up in a very well-to-do, upper-middle-class, white-privileged in the South, where we had Jim Crow. In other words, we were segregated in our. So I grew up in that, and yet I had the same experience that. I know how that may sound absurd, but I'm talking about psychologically, and I had the same experience as those men who were sitting around in that circle. That lack of trust, that lack of really having solid ethical guidelines and clear that I could see and walk to and have someone that understood them along with me like you do.
And the invitation for the men to challenge me.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
That was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, none of them ever did. No. The only group where I got challenged, I ran the first violent women's group. And the local police had said, look, 20% of the perpetrators in this area are women and we need to run a program for them. And will you do it? And I said, yeah, sure. But what was fascinating, I was working with an organization that had a vast school counselor group and they're all women. And I asked all of the women if they'd co-facilitate this group with me. And none of them would. And I thought, okay, something different's happening here. And what I made of that was that for them to accept co-facilitating a violent women's group was to break open the sacred cow that women weren't violent.
Oh, thank you.
Wow.
And I thought, okay. And then I eventually found a woman from the foster care program and she joined me. But then one of the women early on got angry with me in the group and threatened to throw a cup of coffee over me. And she freaked out and wouldn't come back, I said, look, it's a plastic cup. The coffee wasn't hot. And there would have been no harm, except me having to wash my clothes, And she didn't throw it anyhow. And so I had to search around for another woman to co-facilitate the group. And I found a woman doing a counseling program who was a theatrical agent. And I said, look, this is just like a movie script, We got a bunch of characters with a bunch of scripts. And it's live, it's live, it's happening. And she was great. She didn't get freaked out.
Oh, wonderful.
But, yeah, that was a pretty special program.
So where are you going from here, Patty? What is in your windshield? What are the things that you're curious about, that you're stepping into these these vistas, the things that are inkling for you?
Well, before I diverged or segued into this stuff, the question I was responding to, well, in a sense, was what was the voice I was bringing to the men's group leadership?
Exactly.
And I realized in doing this other podcast that my words were the expression of all the men I had worked with.
Yes. Yes.
Oh.
And when I realized that, it was a pretty powerful feeling, you know, and I thought, okay, I get that. And because, you know, where does this stuff come from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't an intellectual factory producing it in my head. You know, I was drawing together concepts and languages to express stuff that I knew. And I knew it from the energetic reality of working with these men. And that's hard to explain sometimes.
Yes. You
know. Soldiers talk about it, that they stop talking about their war experiences because they feel just that other people just can't hear them.
Of course. You know? Yeah.
So when they talk to another soldier, they feel okay because mm-hmm. they feel that the person is hearing them. Well, when you work in prison and with homeless men, you know, you enter into a world that is it's like being on the moon or in Mars, you know, it's a different world. And it's a world of extraordinary honesty, extraordinary vulnerability. And where the men are just so grateful for honesty and kindness and compassion. Yes.
You know,
and strength, yes. And courage.
Yeah. You know, one of the things in our circle that we talk about is, you know, this is a safe space. No one's going to try and fix you. No one's going to try and judge you. This is a place where we can work to connect ourselves, you know, our head and our heart, and then learn how to speak and get do-overs, you know. Because nobody's going to call, that's something a little bit different. Nobody's going to call you out or challenge what you've said because we're trying to learn to speak. And it's very powerful an experience to watch the evolution of men. You know, when you were talking about you bringing, you know, all the men that you'd connected with to that circle, it really, I can resonate with that because when we have 20 guys in our circle, 20, 25, we tend to be, you know, middle-aged and older. We have over 1,000 life years. If I add everybody's age up, 1,000 life years right there in that circle. And there's something that, you know, that would be beneficial to me. And if we can learn how to speak, and to add to that, you know, Dennis and Patty, each one of the 20 guys in that circle, they bring their ancestors and they bring all the men that they know represented in that circle. So the power of the presence that's there. And I hadn't thought about it like that, Patty.
I hadn't, our years
of experience, but all that I'm bringing behind me is present there. And that's huge.
Yeah. So what I was attempting and the voice I was bringing to the 60-page men's leadership resources thing was as complete a discussion of all of that and all of the aspects of facilitating men's groups that I could bring, you know. And it, at the end of it, I published it 4 weeks ago online as just a downloadable PDF. And I want to put it on Amazon,
right,
as an Audible and a Kindle, because a lot of men won't read a 60-page manual. You know, it's just, it's not, you know, it's hard work.
Yep.
You know, it's, so I think the Audible, it will be a lot more accessible.
Yeah.
And in the process of that, I became aware of needing an aspirational archetype, a new archetype for men, you know,
mm-hmm.
that there was what I called a phase one men's group and a phase two. And the phase two, in a sense, hasn't been born yet. The phase one is the emotional support and the development of the emotional intelligence to allow men to be more resourceful and functioning. The phase two was rising to the challenge of the leadership in men that we need in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And that was dealing with ethics as the five guidelines, values, and statements around compassion and all that sort of stuff. And I named that the mature man.
Yes.
And that was after discussion with other men about what language, you know, it could be conscious man and new man mm-hmm. and everything else. But mature man was the one that they resonated with them. And it was also, in my defining that, I was very keen to be clear of what I call the materialistic success type archetypes for men.
Right.
Not that I was seeing anything wrong with them, but to keep the mature man definition free of them.
Mm-hmm.
You could be a martial arts expert and a mature man, but being a martial arts expert was not being a mature man. You could be a tantric sex warrior and a mature man, but a tantric sex warrior on its own had nothing to do with being a mature man. You could be a gym fitness freak and a mature man, but you couldn't be a gym fitness freak and have that be a mature man. So to make the concept of mature man accessible to all men, from ballerinas or ballet mm-hmm. dancers to lumberjacks, you know,
mm-hmm.
to small men, big men, fat men, you know, any man. And I find that for me, that's very important, because we have many people or men touting coaching programs and performance programs that are still based on the old paradigm of the successful man.
Yes.
Strength, power,
mm-hmm.
sexual prowess, all those sorts of things. And they are so not what we need in modern society, you know. So the mature, and part of the mature man, you know, is, it came about from when I was president of a men's organization in Tasmania. We had a very big exhibition that was very successful. It was called Men with Heart. And we happened to have had a professional photographer as a young man come to our gatherings for 17 years. And he'd become an award-winning photographer by the end of it. And we had 17 years of photography. And we got a government grant to do an exhibition. And we did 13 video stories as well. And we had text statements and poetry from the men. So we had an exhibition, Men with Heart, with the photographs, with the text, with the poetry, and the video stories. And they're all hung on industrial metal safety scaffolding, like metal mesh. And we had luggage tags hanging from it for people to write their comments.
Wow.
And we didn't know how this would go. You know, we just did it. And it was a roaring success. And we had mainly women coming in and just crying, you know.
Yeah.
And they'd leave and they'd be crying and we'd stop and talk to them, you know. And it was just such an extraordinary experience, you know. Like, what was happening, you know? Like, why were people coming in and crying, you know? And that was a few years ago, right at the peak of the media narrative here and in the Western world, the toxic male narrative. And we had particularly women who had sons who were very distressed for their sons about all these negative stereotypes for men. And one of the women who was a senior public librarian, you know, she had two boys and one was about 30 and suffered from depression. And when there'd be a firestorm of this toxic masculine stuff, he'd go into massive depressive episodes, you know, like, and so, and they were just so relieved that here were some men who were showing intimacy, vulnerability, beauty, fatherhood, intimate writing, poetry, and men whose video stories just showed the total opposite of the media narrative.
Yeah.
No. And that was, in a sense, very grounded evidence for what was happening in our society, you know. When you get these women and some men just crying, you know that something's happening, you know. Like, you know.
I think one of the things that I love so much about this is that here Clay and I in Austin, Texas can connect with you and learn so much from and with you and to feel the commonality. Everything that you say resonates so deeply with me, Patty. Your experience, it's just so comforting. When I was growing up, I felt like I was the one broken person. Everyone else had it together, but I didn't. And then to know, to feel my heart break open when you speak is astonishingly beautiful. Thank you for joining us today, Patty. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to see you and to learn and to talk with you and for you to tell us some of your stories.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to be able to speak my truth and feel that you've heard it and understand it. You know,
absolutely.
And it says something that this is a rare situation.
Let's make it less rare. Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Patty, would you come back? I would because I think we've just scratched the surface of the conversation, and would love to hear so much more, and compare notes. I just astonishing. I just love it, and I love to hear how your book's coming along, and whatever I can do to support you, whatever Dennis and I can do to support you in that.
You bet. And how we can continue to carry the light and to continue to carry those points in our lives and to have it resonate. Thank you for being you. Thank you for coming into our lives, Patty.
Yeah.
Could I just say one thing?
Please.
Please.
The first 3 overseas sales of the manual were to 2 African-American men and an Indian man from the UK. And I was just flabbergasted. I mean, I never expected that sort of stuff to happen, you know.
Mm.
Those men were clearly searching for material on leadership, you know.
You know that, I just very quickly, my work in Africa echoes exactly what you're saying. Given the opportunity, it's there, it's real. Given the opportunity for that to come out to be a complete male. We'll have to continue that conversation.
Thank you, Patty. Thank you, Clay. And thank you, audience. And we will see you next time in search of the new compassionate male.